I always think there should be 150 people here, so it shocks me when there aren't. But then after that, I forget it, and we just start enjoying ourselves, and it doesn't matter. It just seems to me like it's such a well-kept secret. But we do our best to not have it be a well-kept secret, so what can we do? We few, we lucky few, is what it turns out to be. More pity them. So, let's start with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, Divine Friend Swami Kriyananda, we offer our lives in service and devotion at thy holy feet. Bless us that we may feel the presence of Christ, that we may feel his joy flowing through us, his courage and determination transform us through these words and music, that we awaken in thy eternal bliss. Om peace. Amen. Here is the simple plan for the day. It's very orderly, and it's very progressive, and at least for the last 21 years, it has really worked beautifully. Some of you, many of you, sing these songs in the choir. Some of you sing soprano and therefore usually sing the melody. Others, of course, are in other sections and sing other parts of the song. Nonetheless, those of you who are habituated to being in the choir have had the experience of having the music actually run through you and making your own voice the vibration. Those of us who sing less often in the choir or not at all have received the music and had it come through us, since we're all a manifestation of the Om vibration. Sound is the most direct transfer of consciousness. You know, that's why music operates from a different part of the brain. And scientists don't take it all the way back to Om, but that's really what the power is. It merges with us in a way that other forms of art don't actually do, so it's really quite different in that respect. Visual art is secondhand. You look at it and you interpret it, but music goes right and vibrates right in with us. I mean, people could argue that in various ways, but it's not the point. So we had this idea actually 21 years ago that instead of just listening to the oratorio, that we ought to treat it like people treat Handel's Messiah. The Handel Messiah sing-alongs are an annual tradition where everybody just gets up there and sings. In those, usually you have professional soloists who take some of the harder parts. And if you don't read music, it's not always easy to follow, but still it's a glorious experience. So we had the thought, which is what we've been doing all this time, that we would all sing all of the oratorio. And that means all those glorious solos that you usually just get to hear. And the way we would make it work would be very simple. We'd have a keyboard behind us. We'd have a few of the better singers standing closer to a microphone, not so loud that it becomes a performance, but just to amplify their voices just enough so that all the rest of us can attune ourselves to that. And even more comforting, all the rest of us, our voices can be lost in that sound. Because most of us sing with great glory when we're alone. I remember when I asked Sabari, who has a beautiful singing voice, but she'd never really done any singing, when I first heard her chanting, and I asked her if she wanted to be in the choir. And I said, do you sing in the alto section or in the soprano section? She sort of went like this, and she said, I sing in the shower. I mean, she just had never thought about it because it was always private. So, but when in private, we give our hearts to it. So we want to feel in this that we're each of us individually singing to the masters, and they love our singing. They absolutely love our singing because all they hear is devotion. They're not evaluating us as art. And if we're close together and with the instrument with us and with strong voices leading us, I can certainly speak from my own experience. I think I sing fairly well. And even if I don't, I can't tell because there's so much beautiful sound. When Chaitanya, who's has, as many of you know, he lives in Sacramento now. He has a gorgeous Irish tenor. He sang many solos, but in the choir, he would usually sing tenor. And when he first did this, he realized that there was power in the melody that he had never actually experienced, because on so many of the songs, he was always singing a harmony part. Now, I will have musicians who have asserted that if you don't have the harmonies, you don't have the full sound. So I'm not really going to argue the point. But for those of you who often sing parts, if you feel that sing the melody only, we're not really trying to make a choir performance. We're trying to do sadhana. And so the point is to experience what you think is going to give you the greatest experience. And Swami, of course, started all these songs with the melody when he wanted to capture what he had experienced, the inspiration he had received when he went on pilgrimage to Israel. It was melodies. Some of you have heard me tell this before, but those who are new, he went to Israel in 1983 with Rosanna, the woman he married a year or two after that. And it was he'd been one day in Israel prior to that, but this is the first time he'd actually gone from shrine to shrine. And he felt such extraordinary inspiration in each of those places. And Rosanna's entire spiritual life was based around Jesus. And Swamiji said also, and she'd never been there. It was like the dream of a lifetime for her to be able to go there. Swami said later that his own experience was profoundly enhanced by the depth of her devotion. You know, it helped him very much. But after he got back to Sorrento, Italy, which is where he went afterwards, he said he woke up one morning and he said, as it turned out, he had 21 melodies that all just came to him. First one just came to him, and I can't remember now which one it was, but one melody came. And basically, the way he talks about music, he said music is a language as exact as any other. And it communicates exact thoughts, exact states of consciousness. So he received a first one melody for one place that he'd visited, and it said exactly what he had felt inwardly. And it came to him so easily, he thought, what would happen if I put my mind to all the other places he had visited? So he did, and he said by the time he got out of bed, he had 21 melodies which he would sing into a tape recorder. And he'd also taken slides. The first version of this was illustrated with the slides he had taken on that same trip. So there in Sorrento, he started working with the melodies. He couldn't write much music, he said, because he didn't have a keyboard with him. So he worked on the slides, and then he arrives back in San Francisco. At that time, we had a big house in San Francisco, an ashram there, and he had a private room on the top story. And those of us who went down to meet him and Rosanna when he came back, he'd already written us that he was working on this. So by now, he has this little keyboard, which is about this long. I don't know whether it was actually a toy or what it was, but it was like a traveling instrument that he could just drop into a suitcase. So he had this toy keyboard like this. He gathers about 10 or 12 of us in his, he had a very spacious room, so we're all sitting around in a circle. He's so excited. And so he says, you know, now here's the tomb of David. And this keyboard went, ding, ding, ting, 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 ting. And he just would give us the melody line. And, you know, and then he would give us, and now here's the Church of the Dormition. Ting, 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 ting. And we all knew him well enough to know that this was not the time to be anything but entirely supportive. So we all said, wow, golly, that's just, this is going to be so good. You know, we had lots of true things we could say, all of which sounded really good. Later, much later, we joked with Swamiji about what that experience had been for us. And he laughed. He said, I heard the whole thing. I could hear all the harmonies. I could hear the chorus. I could hear everything when I played it. So it was just, we were living in two different worlds. But he then put himself into writing this. As soon as he got back to Ananda Village, they were remodeling his bathroom, I believe, at that point. At that point, he lived in what is actually, which is, he lived underneath the living room, but now if you've ever been to his downstairs quarters, from the main house, the apartment he lives on, you turn left when you come downstairs from above. He actually lived in the rooms to the right, which now is a recording studio, and the little entryway that you cross through was actually a bathroom. What? A recording studio, yeah. But it was just a big room under the house, under the living room. And they were remodeling the bathroom, and he was totally engaged in this. So he moved into the guest house, what is now the guest house, and David and I moved in to that downstairs room, which incidentally had also flooded. So the carpet was rolled up, and it was just plywood on the floor, and all the furniture was stacked on the back, and it was not congenial for writing music. And then they were doing construction all around, but it was fine. And we discovered that room was a very not supportive place to live, and we were already moving toward building in that apartment, but that kind of clinched it. But Swamiji was just absolutely like this, and he got home about the beginning of December. He worked all the way through the end of that year. He finished it at the end of February. He did it in about 4 months or 3 months from the day he returned to Israel, and just day and night. And when he was working on it, he was, at that time, there was also something interesting this is all history, but it helps us just kind of appreciate all that goes into these experiences. Through Rosanna was part of a charismatic Catholic group in Sorrento, and they were working to bring much more mystical communion into the Catholic Church. In Sorrento, the priest of the church there was part of their charismatic group. The whole group became Kriyabans. Swami and Rosanna were coming together and eventually got married, and Swamiji thought this was going to be the doorway he'd always hoped for into the Catholic world, into the Christian churches, because they were inside the churches if we made an alliance with them. So this oratorio he also saw as the bridge between the two worlds, because the theology was very different. But if we could unite in our experience, then he thought much could happen. So he through the oratorio, he launched what he called the movement of inner communion, which he hoped would move through the institutional Christian world. Obviously, it didn't, but he had high hopes at the time. So that was one incentive, because as he put it, the inspiration I felt in the Holy Land was complete in itself. I had no need to express it. But if by expressing it, I could also inspire others with a deeper understanding of Jesus, he said, I was driven to do that. And as he worked on that, his health began to deteriorate. He began to show significant signs of congestive heart failure, which is a pretty horrible thing to have. And it's very serious if it's left unchecked. His body, his appendages began to swell. He was breathless a great deal of the time. And he said, Satan is trying to stop me. He said, I'll die before I give up. And he just pressed on through. And the day he finished, the next morning, all the most dramatic symptoms just receded. I mean, this was how Swami's life went. His body was often the battleground between the forces of what he was going to use his body for and the forces that preferred that it not happen. There are many stories in his life. So, and as he finished writing each of these songs, this music was a complete departure from anything he'd ever written before. Prior to this, except for the Divine Romance piano sonata, it was more on the with the guitar, more on the folk song level. Not entirely, because there were others. The songs were deep, but he himself said, prior to writing the oratorio, I wrote music to express a thought. He said, this music is to express a vibration, is how he put it. And then it opened the door to a lot of what he wrote later. He felt it marked a turning point in his own musical expression. And so then he starts writing these, and as he writes each song, he just passed it on. We had a very gifted choir director, George McClure, who was very talented. He was a trained musician and very talented. He led the choir. It was an invitational choir at that point, so that the people in it were able to sing relatively easily. And Swami would pass the songs out. The choir would quickly learn them, and then they would come back and sing them for Swamiji. Because sometimes he said the music was given to him. And so he rarely made any changes in the music. But sometimes he would adjust the words. It wouldn't sound right, or he could think of a way to improve it, or it was hard to sing. And sometimes he had written things down incorrectly. So when he heard it, he realized it wasn't what he'd intended. And so things had to be fixed. So it was extremely, a few of you were there, I know. It was really exciting for us. And in retrospect, these are the things that I learned from it, which is, Jesus was always on our altar, but he was still belonged to the Christians. And many of us, for one reason or another, just never really bothered much with Christ. We had Easter, we had Christmas, and we all enjoyed it. But we were Westerners who were more Eastern than Western. It was a bit complicated. But when Swami sort of gave us this music to sing, and even though it was an invitational choir and they were the only ones who performed it, everybody in the community was learning it. And it was a very spontaneous musical time, which it would be nice to bring that back again. And people just sang. We were so happy to have this. And whenever Swami was around, we would just sing. And it would happen when we were out in public. We would just sing because we were all so uplifted. And we were just so enjoying what was coming through him. And sort of by the time that was all done, and by the time it was performed and we'd absorbed it, it was like Christ had become a guru in a way that he never was before. And so what we're working with today, to bring us right to where we are, it's like every master has his own vibration. And each one is a little different. That's sort of the fun of this path, is that one or another comes to us. And it's not, in my own mind, as if, well, like, let's see, how did, I can't remember now who exactly said this, but I think I can't remember how this went, but it was when Rajasi tried to deliver Master's blessing, but whoever was receiving it, Gyanamata, whoever, or Durgamata, knew it was Rajasi bringing Master's blessing, you know, that there was a unique individual vibration. And each of our masters, and I'm sure some of you have experienced it, I experienced it when I traveled to India and was able to visit Sri Yukteswar's Mahasamadhi Mandir, and at that time we could go into Lahiri's house. We didn't go to Babaji's cave, but we went up to where we were close to the Himalayas. We went to Master's room at Fort Garpar Road. More recently, very recently, I've really immersed myself in Israel. And now when I look at each of those pictures, I see those places and I feel something very specific. So what we're doing with this, because it is Easter and because Jesus is one of our gurus and because Jesus sent this whole project to us, and because Swamiji at the end of his life asserted that Jesus was master in a previous incarnation, you know, this is a way of just making friends with somebody else. And so the music gives us the vibration, and the poetry, which Swamiji worked on extremely, you know, with great diligence, the poetry also gives us ideas and concepts and clarity about what the teachings of Jesus are and of what the melodies are saying to us. When Swamiji was writing You Remain Our Friend, which is the song he wrote for the crucifixion, as he said, all the focus on the crucifixion has been on the suffering. He said, but Jesus wasn't suffering. Jesus willingly took on that karma as a joyous offering to uplift his disciples. I mean, it would have been it wouldn't have been much of an offering if he was miserable doing it. It had to be a free will, joyously given, unselfishly love offering, just like, you know, any loving parent sacrifices for the child and never thinks of it as a sacrifice. One of my friends who had two sons, he raised four children, and he had two sons, biological sons. He said, before my last two children were born, he said, if you had asked me, I would have said I was a pretty selfless guy. He said, but after my children were born, I realized that selfless meant you have no self. And he said, it was spontaneous. It was just spontaneous. Of course, that's how I felt. So what looks like sacrifice isn't sacrifice if you know why you're doing it and you're deeply grateful to God to be doing it. So Swami wanted the crucifixion to focus on the greatness of the offering, but he also felt it had to have the poignancy of the moment. So this was when we were living next door at, like, Swamiji knew that we often stayed up awake quite late, and so I believe it was sometime after midnight, like about 1 o'clock, he telephoned, and he said, Asha, would you come over? I have something I want you to look at. So I went the 2-minute walk over to where he was living, and he had lyrics for You Remain Our Friend, and he showed them to me, or he might have even sung them to me, but at least I looked at them on a piece of paper. And they were okay. You know, I mean, like, I could never write anything that he's writing, so I didn't want to be presumptuous. They were okay, but I also knew it was 1 in the morning and that it wasn't the time to say these will never do. So I thought for a moment and then was inspired to say, not every song in the oratorio will be the best song in the oratorio. Which he, of course, immediately recognized for what it was. And he said, thank you, that's just what I needed to know. I was at his house for 5 minutes at the absolute most, and then I was back home. The next morning, he telephones again. I come over, and he has the lyrics that we've used ever since. You know, he said, I just couldn't tell. I mean, like, he knew they weren't good enough, but he was exhausted, and he was kind of hoping they were. But he needed somebody to remind him that they weren't. And then he found the song that it was, and that's what we've had ever since. So, in other words, all I'm trying to say is a tremendous amount of thought and care has gone into this. And it behooves us to receive it in the same way. So practically speaking, there's just a few more pieces, then we'll get exactly into it. We've divided the oratorio into 3 sections for singing. The first 2 sections are just pretty much exactly 30 minutes each. And the last section is 45 minutes. I'll start talking in a minute. It's also marked on here how it divides. Once we start singing, we'll just sing. We're going to sit here when we're talking, but we're going to stand in the altar area when we sing as close together as possible. And I encourage all of you who are inclined to stay at floor level and watch from a distance not to do that. I can't force you bodily, carry you up there, but please don't. Just come into the aura of the sound. It's nice to stand up and sing. It's very dynamic. That's why the choir always does it. But if for some reason you prefer to sit, there's a few chairs and cushions and so on like that. We'll sing just straight through with as little interruption as possible. Todd will play. Those of you who are better singers, we don't have this really strongly arranged, but just make sure there's a few good voices close to the microphone. Karen can kind of make sure that happens. Maybe it's already planned, but whatever. And the rest of, if you're not close to the microphone and you know the songs well, disperse yourselves among the group. Almost everyone in this room is a good singer, so there's really just a couple of us are going to have to hunker closer to the strong ones. We'll just sing straight through. The choir pieces we'll do in the arrangements that we're used to hearing. Whether or not we have all the parts or not is really up to you who know them, whatever gives you the most inspiration to sing. But Todd will play them, and the expectation will be as we've always heard them. It's too confusing not to. All of the, what are solos, virtually all of the solos, with the exception maybe of the Mary Magdalene song, which is quite long, most of the solos are fairly short. And our experience has been that if we sing them through twice, we can all tune into them more. Sometimes it's like the first time you get the melody and the second time you get the words. So again, without hesitating, once we sing it the first time, the accompaniment will just start over and we'll just sing it through twice. Okay? And just if you just concentrate and surrender to it, it's really, at least personally, even in concerts, I always feel, oh, that was so short. You know, can't we hear that again? We actually tried three times, but that was a little too many. Two is really the right number. As soon as each section is done, we'll just immediately go into silence and we will meditate for 15 minutes. You may either use one of the chairs. If you run out, take a chair up to the altar, use the cushions, come back to these seats. We'll have 15 minutes of silent, still meditation. Then we'll have 15 minutes of free time, but in silence. So if you want fresh air, if you need to use the bathroom, the yoga studio will be free by then. Whatever you need, well, 15 minutes of that, then we'll come back, and then we'll do the cycle again and again. Okay? And that takes us usually to about 3 o'clock. So if you need a little food somewhere in the middle of this during one of those 15-minute breaks, certainly just quietly help yourself if you have anything. So, all right, let me just kind of look at our timing here. Okay, I have a few more minutes. When we first did this oratorio, the oratorio retreat, and I was just looking at it, trying to understand it, it was very interesting to me that I saw it divide up into sections, which I had never thought about before. And the first time we did this retreat, I basically just said whatever occurred to me to say. And then later, much of what I had said was transcribed and actually sent to Swamiji, or I sent it to Swamiji, because I'd made a lot of assumptions. And the only thing he corrected was I had said that he always wrote the melodies first. And he said that was true for the main songs, that the melodies would come first. But when he wrote the recitatives, the short solos, they were necessary to carry the story along. So he said in those cases he started with the words. But when I pointed out to him that the oratorio was beautifully arranged in a certain pattern, he agreed with me that in fact it was, even though it hadn't had anything to do with his own thinking. So the first section is three parts. I call it the call to action, which has children of God and a new tomorrow. Okay, and this is what happens when something awakens within us. And the first song of the oratorio is children of God, your time of trial has ended, you know, and the oratorio starts with a trumpet, but we're not doing the instrumentals. But then, children of God, your time of trial has ended. Well, that'll get your attention, won't it? And the whole way this song is sung, and the words, and the whole feeling of it is, you know, here is the good news, and come, now is the moment. Now, whether or not we actually hear the trumpet call in our ears, every one of us, at some point or another, was called to the divine life, whether it was in an incarnation before this one and we just were born with it, or we can mark the line in the sand when it happened. You know, it was just given to us. Somebody handed me Vivekananda's Raja Yoga book, and it was just like, this is it. You know, this was children of God. Your time of trial has ended. I was lost in the wilderness of this world, and all of a sudden somebody told me something that was true. So somewhere we are called. And then the second song Swami wrote was, he actually wrote it for the modern state of Israel, as he put it, a new tomorrow. But the words are, you know, there's a time for every people, you know, to affirm their destiny. And you can make that as much a personal call. And it's a very, it wakes us up and gets the energy moving. Because it's even if God calls, we can't snooze through it. We have to actually stand up. So the first songs in the oratorio are very powerful. Then, of course, it has to get deeper. So the next section of the first part is the inner resolution. because that external power, just like when you do affirmations first loud and then softer, you get your own attention, you get your energy moving, but then if it doesn't go deep inside yourself, you're just like a rootless tree in a strong wind. And that's what we have to work with. So then come the Psalm of David. Swamiji, when he talks about the oratorio, he said the way it's arranged in Israel, it's so funny the way all the shrines get stacked on top of each other. Literally, there's an upstairs room, which they present as the Last Supper room, but they actually say it just represents the Last Supper. They don't really know that it was or wasn't. They don't seriously pretend that it is. It's just something that could have been. Swamiji himself, he said he didn't understand that that was the reality. He said he just felt no vibration in that room. And so he just wandered away from it and accidentally discovered that right under it, literally right under it, is the tomb of David. And he wasn't looking for the tomb of David. He just wandered into it. It's actually a Jewish synagogue. And it's not very large. And Swami wandered into it. And he described it afterward as one of the most inspiring places on the entire pilgrimage. Shanti also found it that way. It's very powerful, very small. There's something that, you know, sort of presumably is where he might be buried in front of you, and people doing Jewish prayers all around you, but it has power. And the Psalm of David is one of the many songs to God that he sang. And it has a very, it sounds like a cantor in a synagogue singing it, which is also very sweet. The wonders that man carved out of stone, you know, wove out of music and called them his own, last, you know, but an hour, as in Greek and as in Rome, whatever the words are, I'm having it clear. Not have it exact, but you understand. We think we're so important, but we're not. And he just says it so poetically and so beautifully. Every time you're inclined to take this world too seriously. And then he goes to Patmos, because Swami also went to Patmos before he went to Israel. Patmos is the Greek Isle where St. John went and where he had the experience that led to him writing the book of Revelations. St. John had a slightly different destiny than the other disciples. And in that cave is where Swami felt the words for in the spirit. So this really shows us, it also shows us, especially in the spirit, this, I've often seen on the spiritual path that often people get to read the end of the book at the beginning of the journey, and then we think we're at the end of the story and we get thrown back to page one of what turns out to be a rather thick volume of karma. You know, that we get a taste of where we're going sufficient that when we're trudging through what we have come to lovingly call the icky middle of the story, you know how it's going to end. And so right at the beginning, we hear in the spirit. We hear the Psalm of David. And it really tells us where we're going. And then the oratorio turns toward Divine Mother, which, of course, because it's the story of the descent of an avatar into this world, and most, well, all avatars, as far as we know, seem to be born of woman. I mean, an avatar could obviously manifest a body without any physical intercession, but it seems that every avatar has a mother. So in the life of Jesus, his mother seems to play a more significant role than in the life of some avatars. But in the incarnation as Yogananda, Master's mother was everything to him, but she left when he was 10 years old. So she formed him and gave him his start, but then even as a child, before his childhood was over, she was gone. Whereas Mary bore Jesus and outlived him by many years. And in fact, the tradition is when Jesus was dying, most of his disciples were too frightened to be there while he was being crucified. They just didn't know what was happening. But his mother and his mother's sister and Mary Magdalene and St. John were all there at the base of the cross. And there's that extraordinary scene, which for those of you who were here last night from the Bible, where the last words that Jesus said, looked at his mother, and then looked at John and said to Mary, "Behold your son." And then he looked at John and said, referring to Mary, "Behold your mother." And then it was finished. Then he said, "It is finished." And after that, as the Bible says, John took Mary into his home and treated her like his own mother for the rest of her life. And the tradition is that she actually formed the center of the life of the disciples, and that it was her attunement that helped keep them strong and moving. And when her death was close, all the disciples gathered, and the scene, the Church of the Dormition, they call it like going to sleep, because Mary died so effortlessly and peacefully. And all the disciples gathered there. And Thomas, who was in India, received the message, and he was coming, but he arrived the day after she passed. But they were all with her. So her presence in every way was important. Now, that's the greatest story ever told. But the other part of it is, for the kind of spiritual life that self-realization is calling us to, for the true teachings of Jesus and the present teachings of Master, we have to have a very personal, intimate relationship with God. And the tradition of the Jews at the time of Jesus' incarnation, and to a large extent of the Christian church, isn't as intimate as Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga, Master said, the only place God can be experienced is in the human nervous system, which always seems like a very unpoetic way to say it, but the point is made. The kingdom of God is within. And we won't find it by looking around outside, and we won't find it by following the rules, and we won't find it by turning our salvation over to the priest. As Master said, you ask the priest to forgive your sins. He said, if you've overeaten and had a tummy ache, can the priest take away your tummy ache? I mean, it's such a common sense question. But that's, he was trying to say, nobody can make you spiritual. You know, confession may help you to alleviate your own anxiety, but ultimately, it's you who have to decide. And for that kind of intimacy, we have to be completely unafraid. And the judge is kind of scary, and even the father can be a little forbidding. We're talking archetypes, we're not talking individuals, because the father is wisdom-oriented, and the father lays down the law. That's the masculine energy. Masculine energy is essential. The masculine energy has an objective reality that must be met. But sometimes we fail. Sometimes we've broken the rules. Sometimes that objective reality is more than we can deal with. And that's where the mother comes in. You know, I'm always so... There's a picture of Swamiji with his mother. It's one of my favorite pictures of him. He's about maybe four. And it's outside of their house in Romania. And he's in those days, children wore children's clothes. They didn't wear just small versions of adult clothes like they do now. So he's dressed in little short pants and some little childlike sailor suit kind of thing, something like that. And his mother's just sitting there, and she's a very handsome woman. I mean, she's a regal woman like that. And he's just kind of lounged across her lap like this, like children are. And you can see it's a posture of total relaxation on his part. You know, just leaning up against his mother, there was nothing to protect. He was very close with her spiritually. He says her prayers were the greatest blessing of my early life. She was a very deep soul. But that's how we have to be with God, and that's just the beginning. You know, we have to be absolutely without reservation, willing to just lay across the lap of Divine Mother. Otherwise, we will never stop protecting our own delusions. So the next step after the call, after the glimpse of where we're going, is that we have to start forming this relationship. And we start with the mother. Because as Master said, there's a recording you all have heard, as many of you have heard his voice, because the mother is closer than the father, he says like that. Pray, and then pray to God as divine mother. He can't resist you when you do that. It just completely takes apart the fact that this has anything to do with men and women. I mean, when we call on the feminine, the divine responds in the feminine. And that's what we're trying to do. So all these songs about Divine Mother, they're about the life of Jesus, and they're also about Mother. You know, God is truth, God is love, Mother of wisdom. And then we go to Mary, there came an angel of God, and we start talking about Jesus coming. But all the melodies and the words, but all the melodies here are feminine. They're all, and what, you see, God is not masculine or feminine. God is attributes. And the attribute of the feminine archetype, is compassion and forgiveness and unconditional love. And sooner or later on our spiritual journey, we all recognize that that's what we need. And so, okay, let's begin. Let's do the first part. Here's your words. And let's just go crowd up on the altar and let's begin. So now we have prepared the way. The entire story of the life of Jesus is his life. Swamiji said at one point that when he was starting to write about Master's life, he realized that it wasn't dramatic like the life of Jesus. That for Jesus, it was the events of his life, which is what people really remember and reenact almost continuously. It's the drama of the story itself. When he was writing Master's Life, there's a certain amount of drama in it, but it doesn't rise to the level that this story rises. So we also, we live very much through the thrilling events in and of themselves. And when one's devotion for Jesus is personal in the sense I mean one's devotion for God is focused on that manifestation of God. One loves to contemplate the events, just like a family gets together and recounts all its own experiences and thrills and grieves and laughs together over all the things that happen. When we love someone, we love to recount and relive. I've now traveled to Israel 3 times. The first time I went, I called my trip a trip to Jerusalem. I never said I was going to Israel. I always said I was going to Jerusalem. Circumstances conspired that I missed planes and I was late arriving. There was some random violence in the old city, so they wouldn't let our tour go into much of Jerusalem. So almost none of what I expected to happen happened. And simultaneously, the experience I had on that first journey about 3 years ago was exceedingly impersonal. There was an individual identity to the vibration I was feeling, but I always felt it as a spirit just so far beyond life and personality. It was a very uplifting trip. But nothing that I expected at all, almost nothing that I expected. And I realized that's a whole side of devotion that you can have. When I felt called to go back last November, which was quite unexpected because I felt I was done, this time I went to Jerusalem. And that time, it was more what I had thought of a I won't elevate it to the point of a past life memory, but it was about as close to that as I could come, as I come, without having actual visions or anything like that. And the way it affected me helped me once again to understand the continuing power that Jesus exerts over the world today, because, you know, as a spirit, as a self-realized master, as an avatar, he just put himself forward into something so, just so many forces had come to a focus. You know, even now, in the part of the world, that part of the world where he lived, because the irony is, you see, he was 12 years old when he left Israel, and according to traditions that are now being accepted all over the place, I even found a book published by the Catholic Church, a children's story published by the Catholic Church that included Jesus going to India for those missing 18 years. So either it just slipped under the censors or everything has really changed. But Master is just unequivocal that during those 18 years, Jesus went to India and had a huge ministry in India. I said to Swami at one point, he had more of a ministry in India than he ever had in the West. But for various reasons, which I can explain, that's not as well known. But the 3 years that were the years that were going to influence the world from his life until now, you know, Master coming, calling his teachings the second coming of Christ, which as Swami said, which he had either meant symbolically or literally. And Swami, at the end of his life, became less equivocal about saying it was literal. That incarnation, there were, even now in that part of the world, all of these conflicting forces come together. You know, and it wasn't different when Jesus was there. It's like, as things begin, so they continue. You know, he was crucified. He's not the only great soul ever to have been martyred, and many of his disciples were martyred afterwards. But it was notable. You know, many avatars are loved. Only a few of them are murdered or executed as he was. All these conflicting forces of the power of love and the power of destruction just all came to a focus. And even now we're looking at that place in the world, which now that I've been there several times and the last time traveled, well, both of, actually all of my trips, traveled with an Israeli. Two times they were American immigrants, so, no, that's not true. None of that matters. But two times there was a lot of political discussion. That's all I'm really trying to say. So one got a feeling of how things haven't really changed, that there's all these fanatical, intense forces fighting against each other. And of course, that's what Jesus had to live with. Now, this is not a story or a way of life or a vibration that we as devotees really want to live in. You know, we've separated ourselves in communities. We've got the four walls of this church. We cling to each other mightily. And when in circumstances where we're separated from each other, we at least try to keep some kind of inward attunement, because this is not a congenial place. What people consider normal is not normal. And it's definitely not uplifting. So we don't want to seek out environments where dissonance rules. Among the reasons why I never thought I'd go back to Israel is that I couldn't deal with the politics. I just couldn't handle it. Now it's like, it, paradoxically, the second time I went, I thought, oh my gosh, this place is such a mess. People like us should come here all the time. Because if people don't come in with the power of light, how will this ever resolve? So, continuing with what I'm saying here, there is this reality to the life of Christ. Now, in the next section that we're going to sing, we don't touch it yet. But we all know it's coming. We all know that the happy little baby did not end up, you know, being winning accolades from the world at all. But so we have to find a way to, just as we have to find a way in life, we have to find a way to go through this story and have it come out lifting us up and not in any way causing us to feel discouraged. I was saying in a class the other night, when in 1995, Swamiji, we were embroiled, we were right in the middle of the litigation years, and the really ugly personal lawsuit against us and against Swamiji was cresting at that point. It was It was a challenging time. And right in the middle of that, Swamiji went back. He had a couple of months where nothing was required of him, so he went to India to go into seclusion. And a friend of his arranged for him to have a little cottage in Rishikesh, which turned out to be right at the ferry dock. We thought it would be way up the Ganges, but it was right at the ferry dock. But fortunately, Swami's hard of hearing. So when he takes out his hearing aids, you know, the world goes silent for him, which is nice. Of course, he feels the vibrations. But in any case, the cottage worked. We visited him. We took a tour over to India. We coincided, and we went to Rishikesh and visited him. And afterwards, he commented that it was a very difficult seclusion. He said whenever he would meditate, he would just feel Satan, is how he just said it bluntly. He could feel the power of Satan just trying to pull him down because he was being so viciously attacked in so many ways, and it was also dishonest. You know, it was very disheartening for him to have this experience. It was persecution in the most classic sense. So he said when he would meditate, he would just feel this power trying to pull him down into depression, into darkness, into discouragement. And that even when he told the story, he said, but I didn't mind. I just kept meditating and gradually it would go away. But then later he said something so helpful. He said, you know, a master can scold you, even scold you very strongly. Master occasionally scolded people with great fierceness. Swami, you know, said this is what he was explaining. But some masters, Sri Yukteswar was reputed to be very blunt with people. And he kept people at bay. He didn't want a lot of disciples, so he made it hard to be his disciple. Swamiji said, but even when the guru scolds you, he said, you always feel it gives you hope when he scolds you. No matter what he says to you, you end up feeling encouraged. And you feel from him that it will work out. He said, when Satan has you, you feel discouraged. Which I thought was such a simple, clear way to say it. Because it's not as if your faults are not pointed out to you or made obvious to you, made apparent to you. It's not as if you don't have to relate to them and keep meditating until the darkness goes away or keep serving or keep chanting, whatever one can do to lift oneself. But when it's God guiding you, there's always hope. And the power of Satan is that he persuades you that there's no hope. So it isn't the difficulties that define it, it's the result. Now, the life of Christ goes in this incredible trajectory from this extreme suffering to the resurrection. And in the Catholic tradition, on Good Friday, they would never have an altar like we have up here. We do this partly because it's practical, because when are we going to put it up if we don't put it up now? But we also do it because every part of life, Jesus' life, should be celebrated. In the Catholic tradition, the altar is dark on Good Friday. And it remains dark until Jesus is resurrected. Swami said, it's a little insincere. They all know he was resurrected. Which is just sort of Swami's funny way of putting it. Swami, this is completely outside of it. But when Swami was reading in the newspaper about the controversy about whether or not the Catholics should maintain a celibate priesthood or whether they should allow their priests to marry, Swami just made an editorial comment. He said, well, if they dissolve the celibate priesthood, it's the end of the Catholic Church. And if they don't dissolve it, it's the end of the Catholic Church. And then he just said, I'm glad I'm not the Pope. So he sort of sometimes put himself in these positions. If I were the Pope, this is what I would do. I'm glad I'm not the Pope. But that attitude toward Jesus sacrificing himself, and we all have to go black as if we didn't know. And Swami, very much with the oratorio, was trying to reverse that. But what we're also going through in the life of Christ is exactly where we come next. Where we come next, you know, Hail Mary, full of grace, and we have these two mothers did meet, and who's John the Baptist, who's the messenger who's going to declare the Lord coming ahead. Now, if we think of Master as being Jesus, and you look at the personality of John the Baptist, you have to say it's Sri Yukteswar, because the personality of John the Baptist so marvelously matches Sri Yukteswar's you know, world renouncing, you know, unequivocal fierceness, which is the personality that we have of John the Baptist, because these characters come together, and you also have Jesus going to John, which is part of the section we're going to sing, to be baptized. But Sri Yukteswar has given the power to Jesus now. And this is a confusing part of the story. I said to Swamiji once, why, you know, why did they put such a confusing part into the story that John is now, John is Jesus's guru, but nonetheless, he's not worthy of being his guru anymore, but Jesus still marks him as his guru. I asked Swami this, and Swami gave me the eloquent reply. He just raised his arms and said, who knows? You know, he said, but just that's the way it happens. There's many, many mysteries in the divine life. Swamiji it clarified it at a certain point that said Sri Yukteswar's realization was not less, but his role was less. You know, he was playing a supportive role. Who knows how these masters divide it all up? Jesus' master remarked at one point, you know, with mock petulance, he wasn't really being petulant, but he said Lahiri was so lucky. He said in his entire incarnation there were no wars. Master said in my lifetime there have already been three. First and second World War and the Korean War. And for a soul who is omnipresent in all bodies and has to and does experience the sorrowing and suffering of everyone, I mean, to live on a planet that is tearing itself to pieces like that was just agonizing. I mean, the masters live simultaneously on all these levels, and this is what brings us back to Jesus. He was, you know, he had to have been the incarnation of joy. We don't follow people who don't make us feel happy. And so what comes in this section is we just start out with, you know, Jesus has descended to Mary. John has descended in order to, you know, be the clarion call before Jesus is born. And then Jesus is born. You know, it's so exciting. And the exaggerated way the whole story is told in a certain sense is not untrue. Because think about it. Think what it means for all of us. This is Master called his incarnation here, a special dispensation. Just sometimes, and when I asked Swami once to explain that, and I said, does that actually mean like you get more than you deserve? And he said, well, that's the only way you can read it. You know, that somehow we get lucky, we get a coupon, you know, we get to just, we pay this much and we get this much back. That there's a special power coming. Now, also in the tradition, in the other traditions, other than just the Catholic Church traditions, but even these are all being endorsed now because I believe they're true. You know, Jesus's birth was not isolated. That there were, as it was expressed to me by my Orthodox Jewish guide last January, at the time of Jesus, he said there were three streams of Judaism. There was the Sadducees and the Pharisees, both groups of which were involved with the big temple and were priests and had different theologies and were arguing for power. In his interpretation of things, the Sadducees were the bad guys and the Pharisees were the good guys, and the Pharisees are the ones who carried on. I didn't want to go deep enough to find out what he meant, but that's what he said. And then there was a third tradition, which he just presented as the truth, which was the Essenes, because they have the evidence at Qumran, and they have relics, and they have resurrected archaeologically, and they even have a little film based on various things showing you. But their interpretation of the Essenes, I believe, is somewhat limited. For some reason, they insist that the Essenes were a celibate order, despite the fact that in their own writings, there's a lot about marriage and family life. But that's beside the point. The way I believe it's more likely is that they were cooperative communities, and society was very uncongenial to the life they were living. And they were the true remnant of true Judaism because they were mystical. They were not priest-oriented. They were not money-oriented. They were not oriented toward the power structure. They were small cooperative communities working with true devotion to be in tune with God. And they were somewhat secret because it wasn't safe, because the power was in all these other directions. And they knew that the Messiah was coming because they had the tradition from the past. And it was said that Jesus was born into the Essene community, and that there's much esoteric that's written that most of the people who were close to him were part of that movement. They knew he was coming, and they welcomed him. I mean, this was their mission. Now, I don't want to exaggerate, but it sounds a lot like what we're doing, you know? It's like we're not here giving birth to Jesus and, you know, raising up potential mothers for Jesus in the temple or things that people say might have happened. But we're a small, dedicated group of people with a vision that is not in tune with the times, and we're working with each other in this actually global network of people who are all connecting and moving this energy forward. And when Master was alive, there was a small group around him, but long after Master passed, here we are. We had Swami guiding us in our circumstance, how to continue that. It's exactly what was going on with Jesus. I mean, there are many people who say he was hardly a poor peasant carpenter even, you know, that it was a far more sophisticated and refined, way of life than we project backwards, whether that is true or not. But they're all very interesting traditions about Joseph of Arimathea, who is a known historical figure, who was one of the wealthiest men of his time. And he was the one who took Jesus off the cross and laid him in his own tomb. And tradition has it, including that little Catholic children's book, that it was with Joseph of Arimathea that Jesus went around the world, because Joseph was a traitor and he could take him around like that. So what it means is, whatever makes sense is more likely to be true. And above all, what makes sense is this is an allegorical story of all of us. We've been awakened. We've gotten a glimpse. We're drawing close to the Mother. And now it's time for this great potential to be born within us. And that's how we try to take the baby Jesus story when we're either, you know, my two different trips to Israel, either we're completely lost in the transcendent reality of this great avatar, or we're holding the baby in our arms and we're trying to put him to sleep. You know, and both are equally true. But underneath it all, what happens is we live through all of the different potentials of our own life. Living with Swamiji all the years that I did, living closely with him, you know, because his life was not smooth and many tumultuous and challenging things happened to him over the years, it was quite a, I don't think it was the greatest story ever told, but it was definitely a good tale. And, you know, some people would say, I love the way we make up truth and then measure the world by what we've made up. It's a very pernicious and extremely sneaky kind of delusion that sneaks into us. Swami said, Satan gets a hold of us through our own false reasoning. Especially in the early years of Ananda, a lot of people had a very strong opinion about what Swami was supposed to be like. And when he went against what they had predetermined he was supposed to be like, they decided that he had fallen or he wasn't worthy or whatever. I went the opposite way. I went from what he actually was and tried to figure out what that might mean, because I thought the chances of my knowing what an advanced disciple of a great master was supposed to be like, on what basis would I make that decision? I actually asked myself one day, you know, and sometimes asked others, you know, like, what has given you the authority to know this is true? And some people would have the honesty to say, nothing in particular. But what I finally learned from Swamiji, and it was extremely important to understand, spiritual life is not an easy life. A path paved with roses is not necessarily a sign of God's grace. And by the same token, a path strewn with boulders and thorns is not necessarily a sign of his displeasure. Because what the Master comes to show us is how to live. And what would it serve us if all the Masters came and just were so different from us in their experience or their expression that what can you learn from that person? You can't learn anything from them because there's no point of connection. So they descend, as Master said, all the way. Master said, even this is number 99 in conversations with Yogananda. Master has this kind of little frank discussion about how confusing it is to be incarnated and omnipresent at the same time. I'm only very slightly changing his words. He says that. He says, of course, yes, I do know everything, but I don't really unless I put my mind to it. You know, see, it's kind of confusing. So you all have to tell me things, because when you tell me, then I'll know them. You know, it's like, what? But it was wonderful that Swami printed it in there, because it just takes your little construct and breaks it to pieces. So on a more just mundane level, what I learned from watching and being near Swami as much as I was not that life is easy, but what to do when it's not. It's just so self-evident, isn't it? What happens when the people you love the most turn against you? What happens when a fabric of lies is used to, you know, denigrate, humiliate, and ultimately convict you of wrongdoings that you never, ever, ever perpetrated? What do you do? And of course, many times, many, many times in the years since, I always compare what I'm going through to what Swami went through, think about his reactions, and sympathize on a level that is ever greater of what he really had to experience. And then I measure myself by his response. I mean, I come up short, but why would I measure myself by any other response? So here we are with Jesus' life, and what we get to go through now is planting deep within his disciples, and therefore deep within our own hearts, what it means to find the path, what it means to be on the path, to participate in the ministry, to do our own sadhana, the parts Jesus comes, then it's time for spiritual practice, the desert solitude. John is the example. He goes out to the desert. Jesus comes and is baptized by John, and the great power of God descends, and then Jesus begins to serve. And we see Jesus serving, and then we also see it from the point of view of the disciples. The few were soon many. Jesus went to Galilee and gathered round his chosen few. How does it say? In their youth, in their joy, all they asked was the freedom to love. I mean, there it is. That's the spiritual path. And you also get that innocence of it. When the first 10 years that I was at Ananda, until longer than that, but especially those first 10 years, I call it my childhood. I tell people that I grew up at Ananda, and they kind of try to do the math and they can't make it work because I was 24 when I started. But my first 10 years were my childhood. Just so innocent, so free, so all, you know, in our youth, in our joy, all we asked was the freedom to love. Nothing mattered. Then more responsibilities came. Then persecution came. And when the persecution really hit strongly, I said on more than one occasion, thank God I've had other experiences than this. You know, if this were my whole experience, I don't know if I could hold to it. So this is the life of Jesus. He's come. We found him. You know, we're doing our sadhana. We're going out into the desert. We don't need anything but just to sing and be with our glorious guru. You know, and then we serve. Then we help other people. And we're all so happy. Which makes us know that when the other side of that coin strikes, we know what we're doing and we know why we're doing it. And the other side of the coin will always strike. I remember once in my life saying, you know, this is a very good period. And I sort of looked around like in a slightly paranoid manner. And I know that pretty soon it won't be such a good period anymore. You know, and then this is a very bad period. But pretty soon this will pass too. And the extraordinary contrast in the life of Christ. And we don't survive it by holding back. And see, that's sort of this false spiritual idea that begins to come. I'm supposed to be detached. But to be detached, many people think, means to be uncommitted. And therefore, I never really open myself to people, to experiences. I never commit myself to projects. I never commit myself to trying to be the best I am because I want to be detached. There's a truth, but there's a very fine line between fear and detachment. And what Jesus gives us with what the spiritual path gives us with this joyous innocence is what it feels like to open our lives completely. And when we realize that that is the source of our joy, not the fact that everything is going our way, but the fact that we've expanded our boundaries and are unafraid. And then we get to find out what will happen when that habit of being becomes more difficult to sustain. But first, let's go through the birth of Jesus, his ministry, and our sadhana. So, there's two songs in this section, The Temptation of Christ and Three Wise Men Came. We don't have the musical arrangements here. Most of you can hear them in your mind. We'll have, hopefully, people singing them clearly enough that we can all just stumble along. And when you're in either the trios or the quartets, you can be Jesus, you can be Satan, you can be one of the angels, you can be any one of the three wise men you want to be, okay? Or all of the above. In the life of Jesus, there were two different realities that sort of went in and out in an external way. It's vivid in my mind because I can see it geographically, so I'll try to express it to all of you. Israel's not a very large country, so the whole area where Jesus was living for these last 3.5 years was quite small. Jerusalem, the ancient, extraordinary holy place at that time, was the extraordinary center of Jewish power, with this temple that was, you know, it's a paradox, because now the Jewish people think of this as the glory days of their people when they had this building. Of course, we can't see it because it was destroyed 70 years after the death of Jesus. But there's a whole model that they have outside of this museum of Jerusalem as, however they put it together, as they made as much of a replica as they can. You see all these little buildings going down the hill, Jerusalem within the walls. And then there's the temple, and it's at the highest hill. When I first went to the Vatican, I thought it was big. Of course, this is just a model, so you're not looking at it, but it was the model is the temple is huge. I mean, just so big, so heavy, so wealthy, so worldly. In Jerusalem modern, there's in one of the squares, there's this menorah, which is, of course, a Jewish symbol. And I think it's gold, and it's under glass, and it's sort of the center point of this square where people come to picnic and have coffee. And it's at least 5 feet tall and 5 feet across, and it's all gold. And it's supposed to be a replica of the kind of ornaments they had in the temple there. All that remains of this temple, which is at the top of the hill, which is now a mosque, the golden dome, whatever they call it. My words are slipping me. But the top of the hill was where the temple sat. All that's left is a retaining wall, which is what people call now, they used to call the Wailing Wall. Now they call it more euphonically the Western Wall. And so this is the most holy place for the Jews, because the mount where the temple actually is now in the hands of Muslims, and it's not a congenial sharing, let's just put it that way. So this huge retaining wall, which is gigantic, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's as high as the ceiling of this building, it's at least up to the rafters, huge rocks. You know, it's just like the materiality of it is just overwhelming. That's when I went to the Vatican for the first time and saw the patio, and then I walked through the halls, and, you know, every monarch and ruler in the world is, gives the Vatican, gives the Pope presents, and all of these presents, which are the apex of the artistry and the power and the wealth of whatever country has given it to the Pope, and then it's sitting in all these cases. Some of it is beautiful art. I mean, you can't help but admire beautiful art. But again, it's so material. It represents so much wealth. It represents such a concentration of that kind of power, which is the antithesis of true spirituality. And it, and the mind gets very confused, because we know that spirit is this tremendous power. So people try to express power, but we just miss by a quarter of an inch, and then we miss by 100 miles. So at the time of Jesus, as I would express it, true Judaism was in the hands of the Essenes. But apparent Judaism was in the hands of the temple. So I have been criticized at times, and I now try to talk about the corrupt priesthood instead of the Jews, because I'm Jewish myself, which gives me a certain license to say these things, but people are super sensitive. But it was all Jews. I mean, everybody was a Jew. Jesus, everybody was involved. Nobody else cared. It wasn't until after Jesus died, when Paul took it to the Gentiles that went outside of Judaism. It was Jews fighting with Jews about what is the true religion. So on one hand, as I was saying last night, the Avatar comes because his disciples need a certain experience. I was thinking about Master's two incarnations as William the Conqueror and then as Ferdinand III. As Ferdinand III, the King of Spain, and his job was to drive the Moors out of Spain. He was the king for like 36 years, and he was at war for like 39 years, you know, from before he became the king. That's all he did. He just kept driving the Moors out of Spain and holding that, the Iberian Peninsula, and therefore much of Europe, for Christianity. That was his mission. And so all his disciples, you know, they were all at war with him all this time. And the same when he was William the Conqueror. They were picking up whatever weapons they had, and they were going out and slaying the enemy the whole time. And it occurred to me, among other reasons why an avatar would do that, well, that must have been what his disciples needed. You know, that was the appropriate opportunity for them also to fulfill their karma. They had warrior karma that they needed either courage or fierceness or loyalty or who knows what. So Master becomes a powerful general and he takes them all to war for two full incarnations. When Norman was incarnated as Norman Paulson when Yogananda was alive. Norman was a very big man. And Master says, you were my giant then too. You know, you were a good fighter. And there was another disciple there named Jerry who was tough and kind of coarse. And Master said he was a good soldier. You know, because qualities that were a little awkward in Mount Washington in Los Angeles were just terrific. You know, when you're driving the Moors out of Spain, it's just what you want, and you get to shine. You get to give God what you have to give at that point. So Jesus came for his disciples. And his disciples, not all of them, but for the most part, I believe, were in this Essene community. Many were his cousins, you know. I mean, and he knew them from the beginning. That's why the loss of those 18 years out of the Bible is preposterous. I mean, they all knew him. They knew him when he was born. They certainly asked him, where are you going? They probably knew where he was going. Probably some of them went with him. It's just was taken out, so we don't know. But they needed a certain experience from him, with him. And that experience was mostly at the Sea of Galilee. Jesus went to Galilee and gathered round his chosen few. And when you actually walk it, you really see it. Even now, the sea, what they call the Sea of Galilee or the Lake of Tiberias, depends on who's speaking. It's smaller than Lake Tahoe, but it's sort of similar. That's a little bit how it feels. It's surrounded by hills, but the hills are not, it's not mountainous. It's just hills. And it's not even now very much developed. It's not rural, but it's definitely not urban. And you can drive around it, you can go up to the hills, and just you can see the lake, and the lake is just this very placid body of water there. It's extremely serene, And you can very easily feel what it was like, you know, just a little less developed than it is. And you can see that Jesus took them away and gathered round his chosen few in at Capernaum and other places there. And then you go to the places that are famous, the Mount of Transfiguration, Mount Tabor, and the Mount of the Beatitudes. The first song that we'll sing when we start again is the Mount of the Beatitudes, where Jesus was there and he gave them the essence of his teachings. And the melody to this song, the words, blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed those who mourn, they will be comforted. It's the whole enormous promise of the love of God, the motherly compassion of God, which anchors us, which gives us the courage to really give our hearts and anchor ourselves to this. And so Jesus had to pull them, you know, into isolation to do this. In just the same way that we, again, live in small communities or create a community, even if we don't live, we create a community together because we can say things to each other in this setting. We can have experiences together in this setting that are completely unrelated to the world that's going on around us. Right now, the world is heading toward chaos. It hasn't quite completely descended into chaos. But there's a lot that happens outside these walls that we don't bring in here because there's no point. But when you all go to work or go home or go to other places, it's all around you. But we withdraw. We withdraw, at least inside here, so that we can feel something quite different. Now, Jesus also knew that his mission would be very short. He was a young man. He had just returned after these 18 years in India. Those who were close to him had no expectation that what they were experiencing was going to be over as quickly as it was. I often think of Swami Kriyananda. He was 22 when he came to Master, and Master was gone by the time he was 26. He continued to serve until he was 86. But his actual period of time just came and went like that. So Jesus knew that. So he was making these disciples strong. And he was giving him the power of love. And we talk about two souls that were fallen, living water, the joy of redemption. You know, just to those who had no hope for themselves, either because they had fallen into despair or they felt they had transgressed so far that God would never forgive them, because you see, this was what was offered by the corrupt priesthood. You could buy your way, you could cajole your way, but you weren't forgiven merely because you were a child of God. So Jesus had to break all this wrong thinking and lift people or take people deeply into this. So that was, I mean, it's hard to say, was that his real mission? Was, you know, what part of it was real? But it was those disciples that became so strong because of his training of him that were then able to carry on. Because if those disciples had not had that power, nothing would have happened afterwards. There would have been this myth that Jesus died and some people thought he resurrected and that was the end of it. You know, it's a very important point when we think about our lives. Because the Master can only do so much, whether or not that message continues depends entirely on the disciples who come after. I mean, us. You know, this is not a small responsibility. You know, if not us, who? I mean, really. I mean, look how few we are on the planet. Ambition for a spiritual cause is greatly to be prized. So the other side of Jesus' life, for reasons of the necessity at that point in Kali Yuga descending, it wasn't even the lowest point of Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga continued to go down for 500 years. The good news from the point of view of the disciples, which at certain times I envy, is because it was Kali Yuga descending, and at the nadir, 500 AD, everything was destroyed. When Vyasa used to come and talk to us about the yugas, he would just, you know, he had all this research about how all the barbarians just swept through and just burned libraries and destroyed monuments and just took the whole thing down. I mean, the wonders that man does carve out of stone. And we imagine that they'll last, but they don't. But because it was Kali Yuga descending, there was no hope of building within existing society anything that would last. So those disciples, you know, they had to go out and proselytize. But gradually Christianity, you went off into the monastery. You went off into the cave. You went off into the desert. You just turned your back on society. It was hopeless. You know, unfortunately, we're Dwapara Yuga rising. So we get to build because the expectation, the belief, and the truth is we are not in tune with this age, but we are building for the age that's coming. And Christianity was 300 years before it became really noticed. So these things take time. When, as Swami said, we're trying to transform all of society, and naturally it will take a little time. He said it very casually like that. Naturally, it will take a little time. Okay. But the other half that Jesus had to do is he had to have this confrontation with this power. And, you know, Master fought, went to war. He fought to, when he was William, he fought to take over England. When he was Fernando, he fought to maintain and expand Spain. We have this, you know, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Jesus came to declare, and he came to declare spirit against matter. And the song, you know, Jesus against Satan, it was very, very real, and it was Kali Yuga manifested. And he went right to that huge temple. And when they show you around there, they take you through, I mean, much of Jerusalem is just so beautiful, and much of Israel has just been so beautifully built, which is why it's so painful, the whole politics of it. But you go through this archaeological area where they tell you all the priests lived. It was all the biggest, most lavish houses with the tile floors, and the, you know, everything was rich, and the houses were big, and they show you the footprints and all of these things, because the priests lived, you know, according to all the money and the power that they could have there. Jesus just marched right into the middle of that. And he began to declare an alternate reality. He started this when he was 12. That's the last mention in the Bible before he returns to be baptized by Jesus, by John, I believe. Is he goes with his parents from where they lived into Jerusalem for the one of the holidays. It's a caravan of a large family. They all are 2 or 3 days on the road. And then his parents realized that Jesus is not with them. All this time they thought he was just with someone else. And they frantically run back to find him. And they find him just sitting very calmly in the temple, and in the custom of the day, just holding forth. He's 12 years old. He's holding forth. And everybody's listening to him. And his parents are somewhat frantic to have finally found him. Swamiji, when he tells the story, often mentions that when one of his trips over from Europe to America, because he grew up in Europe, and every couple of years they would take a ship across. He said he was a little bit younger, but not much. He said when they were disembarking, he got separated from his parents, and he was just frantic to see them again. And when they, you know, he finally found them, he just collapsed in his mother's arms, weeping with relief. But instead, Jesus, who's been 3 days and his parents have already left, He looks at them, you know, like, why are you so upset? And then he says, don't you know I have to be about my father's business? You know, like, did you think I came to be your son? And we have the understanding of Mary's greatness, but delusion and Maya is what it is. Master says, actually, that Jesus left right after that. And Master actually said, because they were trying to arrange his marriage. That's what Master said. I have no way of verifying that or not. But they tried to arrange Yogananda's marriage too, and he wouldn't have anything to do with it. So what can you say? But he just said, you know, I'm done. I'm not here to be your son. I have another destiny. And then he went to India for 18 years. And then he came back. And that was also his sadhana. Because if a guru comes and does not do sadhana, then all his disciples will say, on our path we don't do sadhana. You know, there has to be an example. And one of the reasons that it's so hard for many traditional Christians to understand Jesus is because there's no sadhana. He just appeared, he was God's son, that's that. And the reason it was taken out was because the priests thought it would lessen people's faith if they thought that Jesus went to the Himalayas to study with those masters. And it was argued, these are all documented. I'm just saying it like this, but this is all historical research with documents that they say are in the basement of the Vatican. But anyway, going ahead, others said, but his disciples believed in him and they knew it, but it didn't carry the day. So it was all taken out. But as a result, we don't understand who Jesus was, or we don't understand how to follow him. But he was there. He was there in India with a huge mission. He traveled all over the country. There's all these, you know, records of him being there. But he had a destiny. He had disciples that he had to go back to take care of, and he had to confront this power structure. Were they his disciples too? Was it his obligation to give them the chance to see him for who he was? Master said that no one crossed his path, Master's path, except that Divine Mother willed it so. So how could Jesus have been in such a powerful relationship, even if it wasn't harmonious with these great souls, unless they also had a destiny with him? You know, it's just, the whole thing is so magnificent in so many ways. And so when Jesus was there during those 3.5 years, there was this constant interplay of him moving toward that power structure, you know, taunting and baiting it and challenging it and contradicting it and going into the temple and driving the money changers out. You've made of my Father's house a house of merchandise. I mean, that's a big thing to do. These are well-established traditions, and he just came in physically and threw them out. I mean, picture it. It was not everyone approved. And then the priests, seeing what they had in him, this dynamic began to develop, and they would try to egg him on to say something that was actionable, that they could have him arrested for. And that's what you hear for those of you here last night, at the end of the story, the Pontius Pilate has him, and he says to the Jewish people, I have no case against him. Well, he's broken our law. He's claimed to be one with God, and that's a punishable offense. Death is the punishment for that kind of blasphemy. And the priest said, we can't put him to death. Only you as a Roman can put him to death, but we demand he be put to death. He's broken our law, and you must execute him. Pontius Pilate, as it is told, his wife had a dream about Jesus the night before. And she saw who he was, and she sent a note to her husband who was there saying, have nothing to do with you know, executing this man. You do not want this to be your destiny. And he tried to extricate himself, but did not have the courage. But he was frightened. And that's also why he kept trying to extricate himself, because he could feel the power of this man, because he was the one who wrote the King of the Jews, because that's who he appeared to be. So his disciples, however, out there in Galilee, singing, blessed are he, you know, he who clothes the field with lilies, he who sinned is redeemed. And they feel the power of Jesus, and they just couldn't help but think that the way this story would end would be everyone would see it, and it would usher in a golden age. You know, the Jews would be restored, they would come out from under even the oppression of the Romans, you know, that's what they thought, because it was self-evident to them that Jesus had the power to do it. And that's, as I was mentioning last night, Judas was frustrated. It wasn't that Judas didn't have faith in Jesus. It's much more subtle than that. It wasn't like, oh, I've lost faith in this guy, I think I'll throw him to the wolves. It was just the opposite. He had total faith in Jesus, but he didn't think that Jesus knew how to conduct himself. So Judas tried to force Jesus to declare himself. That was his plan. And that's why immediately when he saw that that didn't happen, Judas took his own life. If he had no faith in Jesus, why would he have cared? What difference would it have made? But his plan, so misguided, because based on worldly power, it just proved a disaster. But Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen. He knew that blood must be spilled. He knew that sacrifice would bring power. He knew that through this action, he would liberate his disciples and that their power would take his mission forward. And so they just had to stand in utter bewilderment. I mean, to the point where Peter, who was one of his most stalwart disciples, was terrified to tell anyone that he even knew Jesus. I mean, put yourself into what state of mind Peter must have been in after all that he had been through. He was present on the Mount of Transfiguration when he saw Jesus elevated in light with Moses and Elijah on either side of him. I mean, there it was. And still, in that moment, it also makes one very humble because we really don't know. You know, we do our best, but we really don't know. But of course, the end of the story of Peter is that when Jesus resurrected and returned, for 40 days, Jesus just periodically showed up here and there and everywhere. And when he went to they call it Peter's primacy, because the Catholic Church reads this in a certain way, it's Tagba. It's this place on the Sea of Galilee where Jesus appeared on the shore and was cooking fish, and the fishermen were out here and Peter was out here, and then they all came. They didn't recognize Jesus at first. The cooking fish is such an interesting touch. And you go there and there's a little church built around the rock on which he was cooking the fish. And I don't know if he was cooking the fish, but there's a whole lot of power there. Whatever it is, there's a lot of power. There's no fish anymore, but there's a lot of power. But then three times, Jesus said to Peter, "Do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, I love you." And then a few moments later, Jesus just asked again, "Do you love me, Peter?" "Yes, Lord, I love you." And then in the Bible, it says Peter's becoming upset. Jesus asked him one more time, "Do you love me?" Peter says, "Yes." Three times denied, three times affirmed. It's just such a beautiful story. And that puts us where we're meant to be. So Jesus' disciples had to go through this unbelievable, unexpected. In November, when I started walking up, the way it's set up in what people call the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The sepulchre is the cave where Jesus was laid. And like these things over time, the sepulchre, I guess there was a mountain there at one point, the sepulchre was a cave, and not very big. When you go all the way into where Jesus' body was laid, four people could kneel in front of this place where the body was laid. So that's how big it is. And there's a little ante room which maybe about 10 people can stand in. And the whole thing, over the whole thing, there's a small chapel built. If you've seen the Portiuncula in Assisi, you know this. There's a small, very small chapel built right over these two small rooms. This is smaller than the Portiuncula. And then over that, there's a huge church, a very large church, but very old and very interwoven. You know, it's not just a clean, big cathedral. And covered by that huge roof is the hill where Jesus was crucified. And now you walk up these rather steep stairs to this elevated platform area, altar area, and they have a recreation of the cross and a recreation of Mary and Mary Magdalene, and they have a square hole in the rock where the cross actually would sit, and you can sort of, for some reason, you have to crawl under this table. And then there's rocks, real rocks, here, that were where it all was. And then you come down from that, literally, it's all, this is very small, you just come down from that, and there's this huge marble slab, which is about the size of a small bed, which is after they took Jesus' body off the cross, they laid it on that slab and anointed it with oil, then they picked it up and walked a few steps over and put it into the sepulcher. So one comes into all of this, and then you start up those stairs, and you know, that was when, you know, I sort of, I don't know, some part of my soul remembered. And I felt incredible grief, just incredible grief. But it wasn't, you know he was resurrected, but it was more like what it felt like when it happened. And all that everyone had to find in themselves to go on from this. And then to discover, I mean, really 3 short days later, then to discover that it wasn't anything that it seemed. You know, what an extraordinary reality that is, isn't it? And is that any different than the life we're living? Just this morning, I've been trying to think about the dream nature of the universe, which is not self-evident to me. But all of us know that when you wake up from a dream, you feel the experience, but you know it wasn't what it seemed. Now, just even try. Like, what if we woke up right now? Just think of all, just each of us, just the adventures of this life and how poignant so many of them have been. You know, what to speak of the unresolved poignancies of previous lives, walking up those stairs to where Jesus was crucified. I thought, I've never really come to terms with this. That's actually what crossed my mind. Well, this is like such long, unfinished business. You know, I just haven't really fully accepted what this was and why it happened. You know, and now I get to, which is why I was compelled to go back. You don't have to geographically relocate yourself, but sooner or later, you have to come to terms with all of it. And this story is about as intense and concentrated an adventure of the glory of Palm Sunday, the bliss of the Last Supper, the arrest, the crucifixion, and then the resurrection. So we just get to run through it all. And the purpose of it is the glory of God, which in and of itself just lifts us above our petty concerns. But the greater glory of it is, so also, for this hour was I also born. You know, his destiny is my destiny. His journey is my destiny, my journey. And ultimately, that's the message. So, let's go finish the story.